It's a great pleasure to introduce the next speaker, who's Edward Witten from the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He's celebrated for many contributions to a range of areas in theoretical physics, mostly connected with elementary particle physics and cosmology. Over many years, his work on quantum field theory and string theory has transformed those subjects, particularly through his ability to bring powerful mathematics to bear on problems in physics in a way that is unrivaled by anyone else. At the same time, he's unique in another way. He's made many major contributions in mathematics, which are characterized by his intuition that he brings from theoretical physics. This seems to be most unusual. It seems to be unusual for pure mathematicians to accept someone with as impure a background as that of a theoretical physicist. But Edward is obviously the unique exception, being given the ultimate mathematical accolade when he was awarded a Fields Medal in 1990.
So I'll be telling you a little bit about modern developments in theoretical physics and to some extent how they fit in with Dirac's legacy. So string theory, which we've had our meeting about this week here in Cambridge, is a modern approach to the elementary particles, according to which, roughly speaking, a particle such as an electron or one of the other particles, a quark or a neutrino or a photon, is more accurately described as a little vibrating string rather than a point particle subject to quantum laws. Yet string theory, though it seems modern, is reminiscent of many of Dirac's ideas. Perhaps the most obvious has to do with the fact that Dirac was a pioneer in trying to understand how relativity would be compatible with having extended objects such as strings, or the membranes that he considered, but also many other aspects of Dirac's work. Many of which you can read more about in that lecture that you've received and which Michael T. has just read from. So one thing that Dirac emphasizes is the aim to achieve unity in understanding of physics and mathematics. Just to give you a hint of how string theory aims to achieve unity, if you think of a violin or a piano string, it can vibrate in many different shapes, which are result in the harmonics or higher overtones in music. There will be middle C and also its higher overtones. And that yields the beauty of music. You can get a pure tone with a tuning fork, but a piece of music played with tuning forks will sound very ugly and very harsh. This comes from the higher harmonics or the different ways that the string can vibrate. And for this kind of string, the quantum string can vibrate in many different shapes, and the different ways that it can vibrate give the different elementary particles, not the higher harmonics that are responsible for the richness of music, but in this case the different elementary particles that we see in different aspects of nature. Well, this string theory has a long history. It originated back around 1970, and we're nowadays still today trying to understand it, and probably far from being finished. And it's faced many problems, but one problem I'm going to stress that was faced by the theory in its early days was that it seemed to describe only one of the two kinds of particles we see in nature. There are the bosons, of which, for example, light waves are made out of bosons. But the second kind of particle, which was invented by Fermi and Dirac and are called fermions or Fermi-Dirac particles, the second kind of particle seemed to be missing in string theory in its early days. Yet these Fermi-Dirac particles include many of the most familiar ones, such as the electron, the proton, and the neutron, and many others, the muons, neutrinos, and so on. They are the particles which, in a way, are most obvious as being particles, whereas the other class of particles, the bosons, when we first meet them, seem more like waves than particles. And they're the particles that are described by the celebrated Dirac equation, whose origin Michael Atiyah has just reviewed, and which you can also see written right up here in front of the podium. So, in Dirac's equation, I won't explain the details, but I will say that there are these things that we call Dirac matrices, which were a kind of relativistic extension of the imaginary quaternion units of Hamilton that Michael Atiyah just reminded us about. So Dirac's equation describes particles like electrons that avoid each other, thus producing the stability of matter. So the other kind of particles, the bosons, they travel in large groups. So when we look at a light bulb with our eye, we're detecting not a single particle, but many at once, building up a macroscopic signal that we can see with our eye without requiring 20th century technology. But understanding the existence of these other Fermi-Dirac particles is basically a question of 20th century and 21st century technology. Because they avoid each other, you have to study them one at a time, and their tendency to avoid each other is ultimately what makes possible the stability of solid matter. So one of the problems of string theory in the early days was that it was missing Dirac's particles. It had the bosons, but not the Fermi-Dirac particles. And this problem was overcome just about a little over 30 years ago when Pierre Raymond had the brilliant idea that as well as ordinary waves on a string, there should be a more abstract kind of waves on the string, which were Dirac matrices. So instead of just having the imaginary quaternion units I, J, and K, and their relativistic version that was introduced by Dirac, Raymond said that the Dirac matrices should be allowed to travel up and down the string. So there was a string that could vibrate in space, and when it moved around, it carried with it its own Dirac matrices everywhere it went. So in the process, Raymond discovered a new equation, which is often called the Dirac-Raymond equation. I noticed that one of the speakers at the string meeting referred to it by this name. And it's kind of stringy extension of Dirac's original equation. I do want to say that there have been lots of other important developments in this subject, but I'm not going to be mentioning the work of my other colleagues because there isn't time. I thought that on the Dirac centennial, this particular contribution of Raymond's was worth citing. Well, the Dirac-Raymond equation has developed in a lot of ways since 1970. It turned out to be one of the seeds of something which is possibly much bigger, a new way of thinking about space and time. What are space and time? Well, our understanding of what space and time are were transformed just about a century ago by Einstein. That's what he did with the relativity theory. So to boil it down to a nutshell, there were a couple of really big ideas. One is that space and time were not separate entities, but they were combined in a more harmonious concept of space-time. And the second and deeper one is that gravitation was understood as a consequence of the property of space-time. For example, the sun was understood by Einstein as bending the space around it, and a planet, when it's orbiting the sun, is actually seeking the quickest path in the space-time that's been distorted by the presence of the sun. So gravity was given a much newer and deeper explanation in terms of the properties of space and time. So this was really achieved before Dirac had arrived on the scene. And in the following decade, or two decades after Einstein's work, Dirac and his contemporaries changed almost everything else in physics, but Einstein's concepts of space-time survived down to the present, making them an anomaly. If you ask what was really understood in physics, let's say when Paul Dirac was a schoolboy, and what has survived and is still our best understanding today, one of the relatively few areas where our most fundamental concepts have survived down to the present are in Einstein's concept of space-time. Maybe others would be in more macroscopic areas of physics, like thermodynamics, which are universal despite the progress of physics in particular branches. Although Einstein's conception of space and time has survived down to the present, we know that it can't be the whole story. And that's because Einstein's theory works beautifully for stars, galaxies, and the universe as a whole, but in the realm of Dirac's greatest contributions, the atoms and the subatomic particles, Einstein's theory doesn't work. It makes a mess. It leads us to a web of contradictions. So something is missing that would enable us, roughly speaking, to combine the work of Einstein with the work of Dirac. Well, the Dirac-Raymond equation proved to be one of the seeds of a new perspective on space-time, which might potentially enable us to solve this problem. I won't have the time to explain some of the other seeds. And what I'll focus on today is that the Dirac-Raymond equation was one of the seeds of something that we call supersymmetry, and beyond that, a key ingredient in the emergence of superstrings. Well, what is supersymmetry? In Einstein's day, physics only dealt with quantities that can be measured by numbers, quantities like pressure, temperature, and electric field. So, likewise, in everyday language, we measure space and time by numbers. It's now 2 o'clock, we're 300 meters above sea level, and so on. And this is one bit of common sense that Einstein preserved. In that sense, Einstein kept that part of reality. Space and time was measured by numbers, but the equations governing the numbers were different ones, and many of the concepts were different besides. With quantum mechanics, we learned that there are more subtle things, like Dirac's beloved spin of the electron, which has to do with the spinners, whereas Atiyah explained to us, in some sense, quantum mechanics, the Schrodinger wave function, the Dirac equation, deals with things that are more subtle than numbers. You've got to square them before you come down to planet Earth and get something that makes sense in an intuitive way in the ordinary world, like pressure, electric field, and temperature, of things that we measure in the ordinary way by numbers. These are things that can't be described by numbers. They bring us to the world of matrices and quantum states and imaginary numbers and so on. So, in our modern understanding of physics, infinitesimal variables, which are related to Fermi-Dirac particles, as numbers are related to bosons being what you call the light waves and so on, these appear almost everywhere in our modern description of physics. Where they don't appear is in our understanding of space-time, where Einstein's ideas still prevail. But the Dirac-Raymond equation was one of the seeds of this idea of supersymmetry, which introduces new variables, roughly speaking, new quantum dimensions in the structure of space and time. Beginning, if it's correct, the process of updating Einstein's theory in the light of quantum mechanics. If supersymmetry is right, then the particles we know, the electron and its surprising cousin, the positron that Dirac predicted, have yet other cousins or superpartners that arise from the vibrations of the known particles in the quantum dimensions. So Dirac told us that the electron had a cousin of opposite charge, the positron, and if supersymmetry is right, we'll ultimately discover a new cousin of the electron, which instead of having opposite charge, will have different spin. It'll be in the bosonic world rather than the Fermi-Dirac world. So this is the new conception about space-time that is associated most directly with that Dirac-Raymond equation, where Dirac matrices travel up and down the string. But is supersymmetry really right? And beyond that, what about the Dirac-Ramond equation and superstring theory? Well, at least for supersymmetry, there are clues from experiments that have already been carried out, suggesting that it may be right and that clear proof may be close. One clue comes from the measured strength of the main particle physics forces, which are the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces. When Dirac first studied physics, only one of these was well established, the electromagnetic force, and there were barely glimmerings about the other two. And in those early days, there was E, the charge of the electron, there was H bar, the quantum, and C, the speed of light. And from them, you could make something called the fine structure constant, where the name refers to details of atomic energy spectra, whose numerical value is roughly 1 over 137, and which Dirac and his contemporaries puzzled about greatly. Well, that was in the days when, of the three main particle forces, only one was in clear focus. But nowadays, in modern particle physics, we have a clear understanding and detailed experimental and theoretical study of these three main forces. So instead of just a fine structure constant, there are three of these. And one of the achievements of particle accelerators, such as the LEP accelerator at CERN, was to measure accurately their values. And one of the striking things that come out of those measurements was that the measured values of the three constants agree beautifully with the prediction based on supersymmetry. So to Dirac and his contemporaries, there was this one number whose numerical value was a puzzle. In modern times, there are three of these numbers, and two of them are still just as puzzling as the fine structure constant was in Dirac's day. But there's one relation among them which has been proposed theoretically based on supersymmetry and which has been very nicely tested by experiments at the accelerators. So it's just one number, and it could be an unlucky coincidence, but it's a strong hint that supersymmetry might be on the right track. Another hint that supersymmetry might be on the right track comes from the modern understanding of something that Dirac called the problem of the large numbers, which he gets into just a little bit at the end of that lecture, which has been distributed, where he considers some large numbers, one involving the age of the universe, but the one I'll focus on now involves the fact that the mass scale associated with gravity compared to the mass scale of the mass of the proton is an exceedingly large number, roughly 10 to the 19. It's essentially the square of this number that Dirac talks about at the end of his lecture. Well, there's a more modern version of this problem where instead of the proton, you consider the W and Z bosons, which were discovered at CERN about 20 years ago and have been studied since then, both at CERN and also at other accelerators in the U.S. So in that case, the ratio is about 10 to the 17. So the mystery is to understand why the large numbers are so large. And it's something Dirac pondered and something that we've continued to ponder to the present day. It's not clear how close our ideas are to being on the right track. But the most successful known explanation, at least for this problem, uses supersymmetry. So there are hints that supersymmetry is on the right track, of which I've mentioned two. One has to do with the measured values of the strengths of the different particle forces, and the second has to do with one aspect of Dirac's problem of large numbers. And there are other hints. I won't go into all of them today. But to be really sure that supersymmetry is right, and beyond that, to understand how it works and to explore it and learn the details and learn the clues about what can be done beyond that, we mustn't content ourselves with these hints. We have to actually discover the new supersymmetric particles. We have to discover the new particle, which is the electron cousin of different spin, just as the positron predicted by Dirac was the electron cousin of different charge. Well, in order to discover these new particles, the basic idea is that if the mass of a particle is m, then you have Einstein's formula, E equals mc squared, saying the energy which you need to reproduce that particle. That's actually a bare minimum, because in practice, you're never, or almost never, able to put all the energy in a particle collision into producing just the object you want. But anyway, the minimum idea is that you need at least E equals mc squared to produce a particle of mass m. Well, if the clues I've mentioned to you have been interpreted correctly, then the necessary energy for producing such objects as the electron partner of different spin should be quite close to what we've already achieved. In fact, supersymmetric particles might be within reach of the Fermilab accelerator, which recently resumed operation with more intense particle beams in Illinois. And if not, the discovery really should be made at the Large Hadron Collider, which is the big project that's being constructed at CERN and should begin operation in 2007. You know, at the STRINGS meeting, we had such an intense schedule that the chairman kept the speakers, of whom I actually wasn't one, just in the audience, on a very tight leash. And I think, after a week of hearing speakers extremely disciplined by the time, I might be talking too fast. Because I don't think I've talked for very long, and I've said quite a large fraction of what I have to say. So I realize in hindsight that there must be a lot of things I've said that could have benefited from a little amplification along the way. If we are able to discover supersymmetry, we'll find a world of surprises, since physicists really don't know what to expect concerning the details of supersymmetric particle masses and couplings. In a way, I'm telling you my own opinion about this. There are lots of published models of particular proposals of just what masses and other details the supersymmetric partners of ordinary particles should have. But at least from my vantage point, it's not clear that there's a favorite among these models, and so the vindication of any one of them would be a surprise, at least to me. And of course, if they all turn out to be not right in detail, which I think wouldn't be too surprising, then they would be a surprise to everybody. So it's a very curious situation, because we've suspected for a long time that supersymmetry might be there and that we could be able to find it and explore it. And if we do so, then understand nature at a much deeper level. But at the same time, we have only a very hazy picture of what it would look like in detail if we do discover it. So up to a certain level, we suspect it might be there. But if we do discover it, it would open up a world of surprises. It would be a very rich world of surprises, because there would be many new particles. The cousins of the particles we know now, plus a few that we haven't discovered yet, and their cousins. And there would be many interesting things to understand about their masses and the way they interact. So it would take years of experimental work to unravel all that. And ultimately, it would take high-precision instruments like the Linear Electron-Positron Collider, which is now on the drawing boards, and which, as Ian Halliday mentioned a little while ago, its basic raw material would include Dirac's positrons colliding with electrons. Well, if we are able to find the supersymmetric world, the very fact that we don't understand what it really should look like means that all those experimental surprises would give us clues that should be, if we're clever and fortunate, the raw material in understanding physics yet more deeply. Until we get there, there's, of course, no telling how far we can get. But perhaps if we're clever and skillful, we'll even be able to learn if superstring theory and the Dirac-Raymond equation really are the 21st century heirs of the theories of Newton and of Einstein and Dirac. Thank you.